Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 19. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 22, the entire chapter. We're going to call this chapter the Red Heifer chapter. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Numbers 18, we saw the duties, various duties of the priests and the Levites, and also their support. The tithe from the people at large to the Levites, and then the tithe of that tithe from the Levites to the priests. So now we start in Numbers 19, verses 1 through 2. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "This is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, speak to the sons of Israel that they bring you an unblemished red heifer, in which is no defect, and on which a yoke has never been placed." Now, unblemished means there's no spot that's different than red on that young cow. In fact, a red heifer, that word means young cow, as John Gill says, 1 or 2 years old. And it means particularly a female young cow, according to Gill. Of course, a cow is a female. If it wasn't a female, it'd be a bull. So the word cow particularly refers to a female sex. So we got a young female cow here, in which there's no defect, no spots, no lame legs, anything like that, no blind eyes, no wrinkled ears. Now, the important question we have to ask here is, what was the purpose of this sacrifice, or this killing, I should say, of the red heifer? Well, it turns out that a lot of people don't really know what it means. Adam Clark says concerning the red heifer, he said it's hard to know exactly what it means. He says this, quote, "The rabbis, with all their boldness," Clark is quoting another earlier commentator named Calmet. "The rabbis, with all their boldness," says Calmet, "who stick at nothing when it is necessary to explain what they do not understand, declare that the cause of this law is entirely unknown, and that Solomon, with all his wisdom, could not find it out." Well, there's a high bar for us to understand what the red heifer ceremony is all about. Here's some speculations. Adam Clark says it was probably meant to typify Christ's sacrifice, and I think that makes a lot of sense, because we read in Hebrews 9:13-14, Hebrews 9:13-14, "For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer," sprinkling those who have been defiled, "sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh," and we're going to see in just a minute how the ashes of the heifer were used for purification ceremonies, "if the ashes of the heifer sanctify, make holy, or make clean for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" So in Hebrews 9, we have the ashes of the red heifer, the ashes of the heifer, put in the same category as the blood of goats and bulls, and I'm sure that's sin offerings, because a male goat was used as a sin offering for a leader of Israel. A female goat was used as a sin offering for an ordinary person of Israel. A bull was used for a sin offering of the high priest. And a bull was used for the sin offering for the whole congregation. So this is talking about sin here and purification therefrom. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agrees. He says this red heifer ceremony was to purify from sin because it uses blood. Symbolizes Christ's sacrifice. Now, Adam Clark has some other speculations. Perhaps the red heifer was related to idolatry in Egypt. The red heifer was sacred in Egypt, and God wanted to show them there was no need to worship a young red cow. In fact, we're going to kill the young red cow. The Egyptians thought the bulls needed to be red because red bulls were needed to sacrifice to appease the evil demon Typhon. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown adds this, quote, "By the choice, both of the sex, i.e. female, and the color, red, provision was made for eradicating from the minds of the Israelites a favorite Egyptian superstition regarding two objects of their animal worship." That's reasonable, too, actually. And, of course, it could be both, purify from sin and to purge the Israelites' mind of a certain idolatrous ceremony that they would be confronted with in Egypt. Now, the requirement that the red heifer could have no defect is very similar to the requirement that no sacrifices could have a defect. However, the red heifer is not a sacrifice, as the NIV Study Bible says. First of all, it was a cow, not an ox. Now, cows couldn't be used for a burnt offering, a sin offering, or a guilt offering. They had to be male. And in fact, the guilt offering had to be a male sheep, not a cow. A cow could be used for a peace offering. Almost any animal could be used for a peace offering. But for sin offerings, and that's what we're talking about here, it's not really a sacrifice for sin because it's a female. It was also slaughtered and not sacrificed, the NIV Study Bible says. And I questioned, well, what's the difference between being slaughtered and not sacrificed? What's the difference between being slaughtered and sacrificed? Not any difference to the cow, is it? I'm not sure what they mean by that, except that it was not done in the temple courtyard. That's the main difference. The heifer was killed outside the camp, as we'll see in a minute. The red heifer was not killed at the bronze altar. Sacrifice had to be killed at the bronze altar on the north side. So this is not really a sacrifice. Numbers 19, verses 3 through 4. You shall give it, i.e. the red heifer. And God is talking to Moses and Aaron here, because Aaron's in charge of sacrifices too. And so he's included in the discussion with God. You shall give it to Eleazar the priest, and it shall be brought outside the camp and be slaughtered in his presence. Next, Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of its blood toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. Now, Eleazar is the oldest surviving son of Aaron. He is what is called the Sagan, S-A-G-A-N, the Sagan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Never heard it pronounced. He was the deputy backup priest, as Jameson Fawcett Brown say, in case Aaron got sick or something, couldn't perform his duties, or he was absent. Aaron's oldest son, oldest two sons, Nadab and Abihu, had been killed by God because they had offered strange fire and it got roasted, toasted. Now this red heifer is to be killed outside the camp. Now this is a type of Christ, of course, because Hebrews 13:11 says this, for the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Well, let's go down a rabbit trail here and talk about how sin offerings are burned outside the camp. And also, as Hebrews 13:11 says, blood is brought into the holy place. Well, how is blood brought into the holy place? Well, if it was a sin offering for the high priest, we read about the bull being sacrificed for the sin offering in Leviticus 4:6-7. The priest is to dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of it 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. The veil of the sanctuary being the curtain that divides the holy place from the holy of holies. And then right there is the golden altar of incense. And verse 7 says, the priest must apply some of the blood to the horns of the altar of fragrant incense that is before the Lord in the tent of meeting. All right, so there's your blood being brought into the holy place for the bull sin offering for the sins of the high priest. Now, if it was for the sins of the whole congregation, we see something similar. Leviticus 4:16-17. The anointed priest will bring some of the bull's blood into the tent of meeting. The priest is to dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil. Again, the second veil, the inner veil that separates the holy place from the holy of holies, 7 times the blood is sprinkled on the ground there. Or maybe on the veil itself, it's not really clear. Now, with the bull sin offering for the sins of the whole congregation, as opposed to the sins of the high priest, there's no mention of smearing the horns of the golden altar with blood. But still, the blood has to be brought into the holy place to sprinkle before the veil. And with sin offerings for the leaders of the people, that would be a male goat. And for the sins of an ordinary person, a female goat, there's no mention of carrying the blood into the holy place at all. Kind of interesting, little excursus. But we're not talking about blood being brought inside the sanctuary for a sin offering. We're talking about the heifer, red heifer, is burnt out. It's slaughtered and burnt outside the camp. And likewise, the remains of the sin offering are burnt, or taken outside the camp and burnt. I don't have the scripture for that, but that's well known. So this idea of sin being taken outside the camp is a type of Christ, because Jesus was, of course, crucified outside the people of Israel, outside of Jerusalem. He carried the sin out there just as the sin offering carries the sin outside the camp when the remains of the animal are taken outside and burnt, taken outside the camp out into the wilderness and burnt. Now, verse 3 says that you, Moses or Aaron, shall give the red heifer to Eleazar the priest. Now, Eleazar does not necessarily slaughter the animal. It says the animal is slaughtered. The red heifer is slaughtered in his presence. So somebody else might do it. Now, Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of its blood toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. The sin offering was, 2 of the sin offerings were sprinkled 7 times in front of the inner veil. Here it's 7 times in front of the outer veil, the doorway to the courtyard from the holy place. 7 times the blood was sprinkled. Of course, 7 is the number of God's divine perfection. The sprinkling means that the tabernacle is covered with blood and is made clean. Perhaps the blood was carried in the palm of the priest's hand from the slaughtered red heifer. I think it was probably drained into a bowl, and the priest carried the bowl and then sprinkled the blood, and the blood ceremonially took away their sins in a divine, completely perfect way because the blood was sprinkled seven times. Now, interestingly enough, once the Israelites got to Jerusalem and they carried out the ordinance of the red heifer, they would sprinkle the, instead of going to the temple and sprinkling the front of the temple, they would, well, I shouldn't say that. They would carry the blood. I'm sure this is what my note means here. They would carry the blood from the Mount of Olives and go to Jerusalem to sprinkle the temple. We go to now to Numbers 19, verses 5 through 8. Then the heifer shall be burned in his sight, in Eleazar's sight. Its hide and its flesh and its blood with its refuse shall be burned. The priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material and cast it into the midst of the burning heifer. The priest shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in water and afterward come into the camp, but the priest shall be unclean until evening. The one who burns it shall also wash his clothes in water and bathe his body in water and shall be unclean until evening. First of all, what does the burning of the red heifer symbolize? Well, it denotes the completeness of Christ's sufferings, as John Gill says. As Jesus was physically destroyed on the cross, so is the red heifer physically destroyed outside the camp. The burning, of course, also symbolizes purity. This is what I say, because fire often symbolizes purity. Fire burns up the sin. Now, this burning of a red heifer outside the camp is totally unprecedented in the Old Testament system. As the NIV Study Bible points out, the animal was burnt outside the camp, not by the altar in the courtyard of the tabernacle. The priest did not lay hands on the red heifer to identify with it, as what happened with all the other sacrifices. There was no draining of the blood or the cleansing of offal before it was burnt. It was just thrown into the fire. Now, in verse 4, Eleazar is supposed to take some of the blood of the red heifer and sprinkle some of that blood toward the front of the tent of meeting seven times. I don't know how he got that blood unless he drained it before he threw it into the fire. So I don't know why the NIV Study Bible says there was no draining of blood before it was burnt. Seems to me there had to be some draining of blood or Eleazar wouldn't have any blood to sprinkle on the tabernacle. At any rate, cedar wood is thrown into the fire where the heifer is burning, and then hyssop and scarlet. Why? What's the symbolism? Well, you'll note that these three items were the same items that were used in the cleansing of a leper, and probably the same idea of cleansing is prominent here. Leviticus 14:14 talks about the cleansing ceremony of a leper. Then the priest shall give orders to take two live clean birds and cedar wood and a scarlet string and hyssop for the one who is to be cleansed. So what's the symbolism? Maimonides, the famous medieval Jewish commentator, said the symbolism was never clear to him. I don't know. I don't think the symbolism's that hard. Cedar wood stands for hardness, permanence. The sacrifice for sin, the sacrifice for cleansing of sin is strong. It's permanent. It endures. It lasts. It's not corrupted by water or by rain. That's cedar. Scarlet, of course, stands for blood. It's red like blood, which takes away sin. And hyssop is kind of a plant that smelled real good, and it also would soak up blood. I've seen pictures of it. In fact, I don't think they're absolutely sure what hyssop was, actually, but I saw a speculative picture of what it was, and the idea was it soaked up the blood when you wanted to sprinkle the blood on something. But it was also symbolized cleanliness because it smelled good, and it was associated with cleanliness. It wouldn't be used for sprinkling of blood here because the hyssop was thrown into the midst of the fire, but it would still symbolize purity because of its pleasant herbal smell. Now in verse 7, the priest who is presumably in charge of the burning of the heifer, at least the priest who threw the cedar and the hyssop and the scarlet into the fire, he had to wash his clothes and bathe his body because he's unclean until evening. And that's not surprising. He's dealing with the sinful heifer, the heifer which symbolizes sin that's being burnt up and made pure. Well, I said the priest who handled the burning, I really shouldn't have said that. This is the priest who takes the cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet and throws it in the fire. He's unclean. And then in verse 8, the one who burns the heifer, it sounds like it's somebody else, might be the same one. But I don't think it's somebody else, because it says the one who burns it shall also wash his clothes in water and bathe his body in water and shall be unclean until evening. So you got two priests involved, both of whom are unclean, and that's not surprising. They're unclean until evening. The fact that they had become unclean and needed to be cleansed, John Gill points out, shows that the Levitical priesthood was imperfect. They dealt with sin, but then they became sinners themselves when they dealt with sin. Unlike our high priest Jesus, he deals with sin, but he does not become sinful himself. He is not a sinner himself. Numbers 19:9-10. Now a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them outside the camp in a clean place. And the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. The one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening, and it shall be a perpetual statute to the sons of Israel and the alien who sojourns among them. Now notice that the ashes of the red heifer are to be deposited outside the camp in a clean place. Now outside the camp, it works like this. In the middle was the courtyard of the tabernacle. In the middle was the tabernacle and the courtyard around the tabernacle, and then the residential dwelling places of all the tribes was around the tabernacle, but then that's the camp. And then you go outside the camp, means you're out in the wilderness, outside the places of residence. Now, this is where sin offerings were burnt, and there was trash heaps out there too, dead bodies and such. Well, you don't want to put the ashes of the heifer there. You want to put them in a clean place. So just as the ashes were clean after undergoing fire, so the place was unclean where they were deposited. If you think about it, ashes can be kept a long time without corruption or putrefaction. I remember when I used to have a fireplace, I would sweep the ashes of the fireplace, put the ashes in a pot right next to the hearth, right next to the fireplace. And those ashes, because I'm lazy, I wouldn't throw them out, but it lasts forever. They're just clean as they can be. And so basically this was an ash pit, and the ash pit was clean. And the ashes were not to be dumped into a trash pit, a place where there are bones or corpses or garbage or anything. Got to keep it clean. The symbolism of that is obvious. And then it says, and the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it, that's the ashes, as water to remove impurity. Now what that means is the ashes were put into the water and mixed with the water. So the ashes were the result of fire. Fire symbolizes purity as it refines and burns out sin, and water symbolizes purity as it cleanses from sin. Symbolism's easy here. And in fact, it's stated right here, it is purification from sin, meaning the water with the ashes in it is purification from sin. Verse 10, the one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean till evening. I assume that's the same priest who threw the cedar and the scarlet and the hyssop into the burning heifer. Although I guess it could be another priest, I don't know, doesn't really matter. It shall be a perpetual statute. And of course, perpetual means long-lasting, as long as the old covenant lasted, not till the end of time. We go now to Numbers 19, verses 11 through 13. The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. That one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. Because the water for impurity was not sprinkled on him, he shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. Now that being cut off, I'm sure, means with a high-handed, I'm just not going to do it attitude. I don't think if there was a mistake or you counted the day wrong, it was unintentional or negligent, probably would offer a sin offering for that and not be killed. Usually cut off means for premeditated, with malice aforethought types of crimes. Now, this red heifer water, I'll call it, it was used for people who touched the corpse of any person. Now, if you touched the corpse of a dead animal, you were only unclean until the evening of the first day. You were unclean for 1 day, but for a person, it's 7 days. Leviticus 11:24, by these, moreover, you will be made unclean. Whoever touches their carcasses, talking about dead bodies, becomes unclean. Well, talking about dead animals, becomes unclean till evening. That's for the animal. I don't have the verse for humans, but it's in the same chapter. Adam Clark said that this extra 7 days, or this 7 day unclean period for touching a human corpse as opposed to a 1 day unclean period for touching an animal carcass, was, quote, certainly designed to mark the peculiar impurity of man and to show his sinfulness seven times worse than the vilest animal. Well, yeah, that's the human beings for you. Made a little lower than angels, but loaded down with sin. Now, dead humans, corpses make you unclean, make a person unclean for 7 days. If the corpse is touched, that's the number of divine completions. Put it this way, you are perfectly unclean. So in verse 12, you will be purified from that uncleanness with the water. That means the water with the ashes of the dead of the red heifer in it. And it's sprinkled 2 days on the third day and the seventh day. And I didn't find any commentators why that might be, but this is my speculation. It would spread the purification evenly throughout the week so that you will be perfectly pure from your perfect period of uncleanness. Now, verse 13 says, anyone who touches a corpse and doesn't purify himself defiles the tabernacle. And you might think, well, how is the tabernacle defiled just because an individual touches a corpse? Well, John Gill says if an unclean person went into the tabernacle, for example, to offer a peace offering or something, a burnt offering, well, then he's defiled the tabernacle because he's unclean. So not only the person, but the tabernacle is defiled. Now, those who do not purify themselves after touching a dead corpse, a corpse, are cut off again. I said, I think that's for intentional, high-handed breaches of the Levitical order here. What does cut off mean? It's ambiguous. It could mean to be excommunicated and banished. It can mean to die and if die means either by the immediate hand of God or through judicial process, capital punishment. I think it means judicial process with capital punishment. That's just my gut feeling. I can't prove it. We go now to Numbers 19, verses 14 through 16. This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. Now, basically, this purpose of the red heifer law is for purification. And the example that's given in the chapter is about funerals because people die all the time, of course. And they didn't have funeral homes back then. And they did just like the Chinese have done traditionally in ancient China, just like was done in early American history before you had funeral homes. The bereaved would lay out their loved one, their deceased loved one, on a table or a bier or a bed of some sort in a parlor or a living room, and everybody comes see him. Well, that means everybody's going to be unclean. So the ancient Israelites were the same way. They would put dead men into the tent. It says, this is the law when a man dies in a tent, and I assume that's because he's been sick, lying in bed, and he dies in the tent. I'm sure it would also apply to somebody who dies outside the tent and then is carried into the tent. Now, death, of course, is the result of sin, and sin is unclean, so that's why we have to go through all the cleansing stuff. Sin and death are closely related. Now, these laws that made everyone unclean, having to do with mourning rites, funeral rites, that separated the Israelites from the Egyptians, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. The Egyptians left mummified remains of their ancestors in their houses. Now, if the Israelites left their dead ones, embalmed dead ones, if they knew how to do that, in their house, the house would be continually unclean. And so God's not going to have that. He said, we're going to be different than the Egyptians. We're going to go through a cleansing ceremony to take care of death, which is a natural occurrence because God did not mean for us to die originally. Now, verse 14 distinguishes those who come into the tent and everyone who is in the tent. That takes care of everybody. If you're in the tent when the deceased dies, boom, you're unclean for 7 days. If somebody comes in to see the dead person, to mourn over him, he's dead. He's unclean also. Now, not only are the people who come into the tent with the dead person unclean, but even every open vessel which has no covering tied down on it shall be unclean. Why is that? Well, because the air of the house would get into the container, and there's death in the house, and so that's uncleanness on the container. That's just a way to really drive the point home. Even the containers are unclean, so put a top on it. I can't help but wonder if there's health reasons behind this, but I don't like to talk about health reasons because although keeping the law makes you healthy, no doubt, that's not the main purpose of the law. The main purpose of the law is to set up a bunch of symbols to show that we are sinners and unclean before a holy God. Verse 16 distinguishes a dead person who died in a different way than the person who died in the tent. Verse 14, that person would die naturally. Verse 16, this is someone who dies outside the tent. I speculate that they would be brought into the tent and make everybody unclean. Well, it actually says so explicitly here in verse 16. Anyone who is in the open field touches one who has been slain with a sword who has died naturally, or human bone or grave even, unclean for 7 days. that takes care of every dead person, every type of corpse that there is. Something tells me that I've already gone over this in Leviticus. I can't remember whether it's in the Levitical law or whether I jumped ahead and referred to Numbers while I was talking about Leviticus. I don't remember, and I'm too lazy to go back and look it up. But the law is not complicated and very clear about how do you deal with corpses. Now we go to Numbers 19, verses 17 through 22, and we'll finish this chapter. For the purification of the unclean person, they are to take some of the ashes of the burnt sin offering, put them in a jar, and add fresh water to them. A person who is clean is to take hyssop, dip it in the water, and sprinkle the tent, all the furnishings, and the people who were there. He is also to sprinkle the one who touched a bone, a grave, a corpse, or a person who had been killed. All right. First of all, I said that hyssop wasn't used for sprinkling of blood because the hyssop was burnt up. Yeah, some of the hyssop was burnt up in the heifer, but now more hyssop is used to sprinkle the water, the red heifer water, on all the people involved in a funeral, as well as the tent where the dead person was, and all the furnishings in the tent, and all the people who came to visit. Hyssop and water, hyssop and red heifer water, cleanliness everywhere, purification everywhere. Verse 19, the one who is clean is to sprinkle the unclean person on the third day and the seventh day. After he purifies the unclean person on the seventh day, the one being purified must wash his clothes. The one being purified would be the visitors to the corpse who got polluted thereby and had to be cleansed. He must wash his clothes, bathe in water, and he will be clean by evening. That's the evening of the seventh day of his uncleanness. But a person who is unclean and does not purify himself, that person will be cut off from the assembly because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water for impurity has not been sprinkled on him. He is unclean. This is a permanent statute for them. The person who sprinkles the water for impurity is to wash his clothes, and whoever touches the water for impurity will be unclean until evening. The water was used, the water, even though it symbolizes cleanliness, the red heifer water, it was used to wipe out sin, and so even if you touch the water, you become unclean. It's neat how the law just goes to extremes to really emphasize how easy it is to be unclean because the law symbolizes sin. It shows that we are sinners. Now, the person who's sprinkling the unclean people, he himself becomes unclean because he has to wash his clothes. Now, he's only unclean until evening. I assume that's the seventh day because he's sprinkled on the third and the seventh day. Verse 22, anything the unclean person touches will become unclean, and whoever touches it will be unclean until evening. So let's say the sprinkler has not washed his clothes yet, and he goes out and touches a donkey or touches a sheep or something. Unclean. Unclean, unclean, unclean. Now this sprinkling of unclean people by the red heifer water is referred to in Hebrews 9, 13 through 14. I think I've already mentioned this, but I'll mention it again. Verse 13. Hebrews 9, for if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who have been defiled. So Hebrews 9 is referring to Numbers 19, the sprinkling of people defiled by corpses during funerals. This is said to be a permanent statute as Holman Christian Study Bible translates it in verse 21. That's perpetual statute by the NASB. I think permanent is better because perpetual sounds like until eternity. No, it's only permanent as long as the Old Testament covenant. The old covenant lasts, which was until the coming of Jesus the Messiah. When Jesus died, that was the end of the old covenant. Now, I just said that the person sprinkling becomes unclean, and then anything he touches becomes unclean. John Gill disagrees with that, actually, in verse 22. He says, anything the unclean person touches will become clean. And he says that the unclean person doing the touching in verse 22 is not the sprinkling person, but the person who has touched a corpse. Well, that's a little ambiguous. If it ever came up in a Jewish court of law, I'm sure a Jewish lawyer could figure it out, or a Jewish judge could. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with Numbers chapter 19. We're ready to turn now to Numbers chapter 20, verses 1 through 29. And we're going to look at the death of Miriam and the death of Aaron, Moses' siblings, shuffle off their mortal coil. Then we're going to see Moses striking the rock and getting angry when the people were looking for water again. And then we're going to see those nasty Edomites refusing the Israelites' passage to go into the promised land. It's a lot of history in the next chapter. Hope you stay with us for that, and hope you enjoyed this audio.